From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Even before the House and Senate authorized President Bush to wage war on Iraq, the media were prepping for battle. It's a costly campaign, literally, for broadcasters whose budgets were already strained by coverage of the war on terror. TV Guide's Max Robbins recently checked in on the networks.
They all say they will have the resources, that their corporate bosses are committed to it and committing to them really giving comprehensive coverage. Of course, you hear reports now that CNN and ABC News are talking about joining forces. I mean, I had one person inside CNN tell me that they had put aside about $35, $36 million is basically an Iraqi war fund, if you will. And that's for all sorts of things, satellite uplinks, getting people in and out of a tough region, and making sure they have as much protection as they possibly can. This is the first time I've heard where networks are issuing biological suits. That's a new one on me. I mean, that goes way beyond flak jackets and metal helmets.
Max Robbins writes the Robbins Report for TV Guide. Chris Kramer, the president of CNN's International Networks, joins us now on the line from Slovenia. Hello.
Hi there.
So we just heard that the networks are arming their reporters with special suits and medicines and maps to make covering a future war in Iraq a little safer. Is that true for CNN? How are you preparing your team?
Well, we have in the last few weeks, in fact in the last few months, introduced a very stringent new policy at CNN, which is we require all of our staff who are likely to go to hostile areas to have been trained, and we have contracts with trainers who put our staff through their paces. This can range from battlefield first aid all the way through to knowing how to conduct themselves in a war zone, knowing what risks are appropriate. Listen, you know, this is an inherently risky profession. You know, we don't force our people to go to these parts of the world. They're all volunteers, but what we do is dangerous.
The business is inherently dangerous, but you've called the past year probably the worst 12 months for the profession. Why was this year worse?
Journalists, whether we like it or not, are now considered as legitimate targets for many groups around the world. We've seen, you know, 8 of our colleagues die in Afghanistan in one single week, you know, more than the U.S. armed forces. We've seen the horrific kidnap, mutilation, murder on camera of Danny Pearl from the Wall Street Journal. Last week, we saw a colleague from the frontline organization in Britain killed in Chechnya. So not ever before have we seen this sort of catalog of misery ranged against our profession.
And I know you were quoted in The Guardian saying that some broadcasters and newspapers were putting costs before lives. What did you mean by that?
What I meant by that was that journalists work in inherently unsafe areas. How do news bosses cope with that? And the answer is they have to put their hands in their pocket. They have to train and equip their staff to operate in these areas. And the notion that somehow, you know, safety is something which is a very private issue to be determined on the ground is very dangerous and very old thinking. We have a huge responsibility for the people and to the people who work for us. You know, we've got to release our employees from that menacing hand of pressure, which I've worked under in past years, not recently, but in past years, where you didn't ever want to admit that you were scared. You didn't ever want to admit that you didn't want to take an assignment because you thought somehow that might damage your career path.
Now, CNN made a considerable mark in covering the last war against Saddam, but this time around you'll have competition, notable among them the other 24-hour news channels and Al Jazeera. In fact, a news chief at Al Jazeera said, aha, this time CNN won't be the exclusive source of news. Do you think that that kind of pressure will influence what you do?
I think it might, were it not for the fact that, you know, CNN has made a judgment and has made it in the last few years that we put our staff before the story, that actually, quite simply, no story is worth a life, that no sequence of video is worth someone getting shot at for, that actually understands that sometimes we will have to reach out to you and overrule your instincts about covering a story, and that competition must not put you in a position where you have to drive down that road that day. You have to take that particular route that afternoon. There's always tomorrow. There's always next week. That's not a level of pressure that we're prepared to put you under. I wish that it was so of all news organizations, but it sadly isn't. There are many broadcasters and many newspapers who wish that this problem would just go away, and it won't.
Well, Chris, I hope you'll let us call you over the next weeks and months as things proceed so you can keep us up to date.
Of course.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
Chris Kramer is the president of CNN's International Networks, and he joined us on the line from Slovenia.
During the coverage of the war on terror, the independent TV news service Al Jazeera had unique access to the Arab street and even to the terrorist group Al-Qaeda. Now it is well-placed to cover any future war with Iraq. While it often has scooped the Western press, Al Jazeera has been charged with bias as well against Israel and against several Arab governments, too. Ibrahim Khalal is chief editor of Al Jazeera, and he joins us on the phone from Doha, Qatar. Welcome to On the Media.
Thanks a lot.
If CNN owned the first Gulf War, is it your desire to own this one?
Actually, if we think like we are trying to be exclusive and to be the prominent channel in any coverage, I think it will distort our editorial judgment. It's much easier to think editorially where and when and how we should cover. And if we do that carefully and as perfect as possible, I think we can do better job than anybody else, like we have done in Afghanistan. We invested in Afghanistan. We thought of being there 2 years before any crisis. I think this was a good planning from our management. In Iraq, we are trying to do the same. We are trying to be in the appropriate places in the appropriate time.
How well situated are you to cover the war from within?
To be honest with you, it's not an easy job. Even when we speak about any future of Iraq after Saddam, it's really sensitive for them to deal with us in Baghdad. Because we are transmitting in Arabic and we are widely watched in the Middle East, they monitor us. And when we mentioned in any interview a future of Iraq after Saddam, it's really a headache for our correspondents in Baghdad.
Let me go back to the last war, or I guess it's still going on, in Afghanistan. Al Jazeera, and by the way, not alone in this regard, was criticized for focusing on what the Pentagon calls collateral damage to civilians during the prosecution of the war. First of all, do you think you were an even-handed broker of the war in Afghanistan? And have you learned lessons in covering that war that you'll carry forward to a war in Iraq?
The most important lesson we learned from Afghanistan war is we must have a backup for any important place, because when we lost Kabul after the collapse of the Taliban regime, our office was considered a target for American planes, and it was bombed. That's why we lost the coverage for a couple of days until we, thanks to our coalition with CNN, we managed to return back to the scene. When it comes to civilian casualties, focusing on the humanitarian issues in any war or even in any crisis is appreciated, because if we lost our concern to humanitarian issues, we don't deserve to be in this world.
Let me ask you about Saddam Hussein. There's been a lot of debate in the Western press about the prospects for a war in Iraq. Most of it, I would say, especially in Europe, against a U.S. preemptive assault on Saddam Hussein. But at the same time, it's in the context of a press that agrees pretty much unanimously that the man is a tyrant, the man is a mass murderer, a threat certainly to Israel and to his own population and possibly to America and the rest of the world. Does that framework extend to Al Jazeera? Do you begin with the presumption that Saddam Hussein is an evil force in the world that eventually has to be reckoned with, or are you hyper-neutral on this issue?
Really, we must be aware of the history. Saddam Hussein was ruling Iraq for more than 22 years now, and nobody talked about Saddam Hussein as a tyranny or as a mass murderer or something like that, because it was very important for the West to have a coalition with Saddam Hussein against Iran threat. If you talk now about Saddam Hussein as a tyranny, why don't talk about the Gulf area rulers as a tyranny? Why don't talk about some rulers in the Middle East apart from the Gulf area as tyranny? Al Jazeera is an Arabic channel. We have people from different Arab countries. We are living in this region, and we know better than anybody else the history of this region. We must stop talking about any threat to America or any threat to Israel. We must just talk about the disarmament and the monitoring operation, the observers, and the return of UN inspectors. This is bluntly the only thing we can talk about, and this is the only thing could be convincing for the Arab viewers, including the Iraqi viewers.
I have my opinions about Saddam Hussein and any prospects for a war, and I'm a subjective reporter, and I try to separate to the degree that I can my personal opinion from my reporting. Other reporters who are ostensibly more objective, news reporters with the New York Times and ABC and CNN and what have you, also have their opinions, but according to Western standards, do their best to keep their personal biases separated from their coverage of any given story. Do your biases or your personal point of view about the situation in Iraq and in Iraq vis-a-vis the Arab street and in Iraq vis-a-vis the West, does your opinion represent the institutional position of Al Jazeera?
First of all, let me ask you, what do you mean by more objective in the very early part of your question?
Well, I mean keeping keeping balance, fairness, trying to keep your personal viewpoint away from your coverage.
It's really weird from an American journalist to call the Western media more objective than Al Jazeera, because what was proven after September 11th that your media was not objective anymore after you were very subjective to your sensitivities and to orders you got from your officials regarding Afghanistan. I mean, we are fighting the same battle. We are fighting against bad information, against blockage of information, against squeezing the information, and ignoring the context of the information.
Ibrahim Khalal, thank you very much.
You are welcome.
Ibrahim Khalal is chief editor of Al Jazeera. He spoke to us from Doha, Qatar.
Coming up, Dick Armey, new crusader against big media, and what news consumers can learn from the Cuban Missile Crisis.
This is On the Media from NPR. We are back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. For his entire congressional career, House Majority Leader Dick Armey has been a vocal deregulator, supporting, among other measures, the Telecommunications Act of 1996 that has led to sweeping consolidation of media ownership. But now, 6 weeks before his departure from Congress, Armey has been attempting to legislate the breakup of one particular media combine, the Belo Corporation, owner of 4 daily newspapers and 19 TV stations. 2 of those papers are the Dallas Morning News and the Denton Record Chronicle. One of the stations is WFAA, the Dallas ABC affiliate. Army himself has been boycotting these news organizations since an election runoff in which his son Scott, a Denton County judge, lost in a bid to succeed his father in Congress. That loss followed critical coverage of his role as a judge in several matters before his court.
Now, were Dick Armey's legislative efforts to succeed, Belo Corporation would need to divest itself of one of its three Dallas properties, a circumstance its chairman has called an abuse of power and naked display of political vengeance. All of this comes as quite a surprise to the pro-regulation lobby. Jeff Chester of the Center for Digital Democracy has spent his Washington career battling the likes of Dick Armey. Now, briefly, they are comrades in arms. He joins us now. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Bob.
Well, they say politics makes strange bedfellows. Have you ever had a stranger one in your battle for more regulation of media and telecom?
Well, I'm grateful that Representative Armey has finally seen the light, but I guess this is the reap-what-you-sow division of media karma, because Majority Leader Armey has been one of the biggest supporters of media deregulation.
But all of a sudden, not so. Let's talk about the Belo Corporation. On the facts, forgetting any question of editorial bias, on the facts, do you think that Congressman Armey is right?
Well, I think Mr. Armey has a good reason to be worried. I mean, you have this common ownership of the most powerful media outlets in his district, and it's very likely they share similar viewpoints. They may also share similar resources in terms of news gathering. So he has a gripe, but instead of opposing further media consolidation, Mr. Armey appears to be a cheerleader for more such consolidation.
Just by way of background, how is it that Belo is in the situation it's in? I thought the current state of deregulation was still such that a newspaper property couldn't control the broadcast properties in the same market.
Well, we have to give Mr. Armey thanks for giving the country a wake-up call. What he is suffering from is what's called a grandfathered media combination. When the FCC came up with its policy back in 1975 that prohibited common ownership of a TV station and a newspaper in the same market, they grandfathered in as those existing combinations, which occurred in a number of cities. But what Mr. Armey has been complaining about, a single owner of most of the major media outlets in the community, may soon be coming to most places around the country if FCC Chairman Michael Powell has his way.
Because the FCC is now contemplating relaxing those regulations across the board, not merely for those like Belo that have been grandfathered in.
Absolutely. Recently, the FCC released their proposed rulemaking, as it's called, that in essence would allow these kinds of combinations. The moral here is that if it's good enough for Mr. Armey to have diverse owned media, it should be good enough for the rest of us, too.
I'm just curious. You have been for many years involved in this often lonely fight against media concentration and for continued broadcast and media regulation. How easy is it for you to suddenly embrace your longtime political enemy now that he seems, at least with respect to the Belo Corporation, to be in your camp?
Well, listen, I think Mr. Armey is just focused on this for the moment because of his son's future political career. But I do think, once again, we have to applaud Mr. Armey's stance because the FCC, under Michael Powell and many others, are saying we can't find the harm in having one owner control most of the powerful media outlets in a community. Dick Armey is in a position to cow the local powerful media monopoly, but very few people will be if we allow these kind of combinations to emerge. What public interest advocates, and I think many others know, is that having fewer owners of most of the media outlets in this country is not good for democracy, it's not good for diversity and journalism.
All right, Jeff Chester, thanks very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Jeff Chester is the executive director of the Center for Digital Democracy in Washington, D.C. He spoke to us from a conference in Montreal, Canada.
Journalism has often been called the first draft of history. But what if that first draft is a fraud? And what if the fraud endures despite many subsequent drafts? This week, to justify the need to take preemptive action against Iraq, the president harkened back to the peril our nation faced during the Cuban Missile Crisis 40 years ago this month, and how we were saved by the uncompromising resolve of an earlier leader. President Bush was drawing from the first draft of history, the one that said John F. Kennedy went eyeball to eyeball with Nikita Khrushchev over Russian missiles in Cuba, and that Khrushchev blinked and withdrew.
We will not prematurely or unnecessarily risk the course of worldwide nuclear war, in which even the fruits of victory would be ashes in our mouth. But neither will we shrink from that risk at any time it must be faced.
This week, major players in the Cuban Missile Crisis, including then-presidential speechwriter Ted Sorensen and former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, flew to a conference in Cuba to reflect on that terrifying time. They have sought in recent years to correct the record of those events, but the national myth seems pretty much unshakable. We asked Fred Kaplan, the New York bureau chief and former defense correspondent for the Boston Globe, to trace that first durable draft of the history of the Cuban Missile Crisis and all the drafts that followed.
The basic scenario came from an article published shortly after the crisis by Stuart Alsop, who was a very establishment columnist of the day, who got the information from aides to Kennedy in the White House who were authorized by Kennedy to give him this account. Eyeball to eyeball with the Russians, crazy generals on one hand wanting us to bomb the missiles right away, lunatic doves like Stevenson on the other wanting to negotiate their way out of it from the beginning, and, you know, smart guys like Kennedy and McNamara and Bundy navigating a cool and calm course through the thickets and ending us up safe to shore.
That's a heroic and reassuring recounting of the events, and it's certainly not the first nor the last time that a journalist has run with leaked information. But do you think Alsop had any way to know that the story he was writing did not, in fact, reflect the events as we now know them?
No, I don't think he had any way of knowing that. This is what people told him, and he certainly wasn't privy to any of the inside stuff going on. And in fact, this was confirmed in the second draft of history, the memoirs written by two of what could be called the palace historians, Arthur Schlesinger and Ted Sorensen, Sorensen being Kennedy's speechwriter at the time, who was present at all of the, what they called the EXCOM meetings, the meetings of the Executive Committee of the National Security Council, which got together for the 13 days and deliberated what to do. And this basically told the same story, though with more detail.
These memoirs by the Palace Guard, when did they appear?
That was in the mid-60s. This was Sorensen's book called Kennedy and Schlesinger's 1,000 Days.
Okay, so what's the third rough draft? When did that happen? What form did it take?
The third draft was mainly by revisionists, by people like Gary Wills, who in 1971 wrote a book called Kennedy Agonistes. Now, it had been revealed early on that Khrushchev had made an offer toward the end of the crisis, basically saying, look, I'll take my missiles out of Cuba if you take your missiles out of Turkey. At the time, the United States had 15 nuclear missiles in Turkey, which were similar in range and power to the missiles that the Soviets put in Cuba. Ted Sorensen, in his book, dismissed that Khrushchev offer as total propaganda and that Khrushchev dropped in the end. Well, Gary Wills and the revisionists picked up on this, and they said, look, this guy Kennedy was a maniac. He was soaking in machismo. He led the United States and the world on the brink of World War III because he wouldn't take this sensible offer to do the missile trade.
Machismo was certainly part of the popular image of JFK back then. Here's a clip from a 1970s TV docudrama, Missiles of October, starring a very young William Devane.
Now we must convey an uncompromising message. This government is prepared to negotiate, but not until those missiles are removed from Cuba. We will not be deterred. We will not be shaken. We'll bomb if we must. We'll invade if we must.
Yeah, that clip is just hilarious. Diametrically opposed to the way John Kennedy was acting at any of those sessions. In fact, this does lead us to the fourth draft of history, tapes that Kennedy had secretly been making. Long before Nixon and before Johnson, Kennedy was taping a lot of things that happened in the Oval Office and in the cabinet room where the XCOM meetings took place. And we hear very clearly in those meetings that Kennedy took Khrushchev's offer of the missile trade very, very seriously. In fact, on the third day of the crisis, Kennedy is already musing that, well, you know, Khrushchev, he's made a miscalculation. He's obviously done this for bargaining leverage, and we're going to have to help him find a way to save face. Maybe if we trade those missiles in Turkey for the missiles in Cuba, that might be the answer. Nobody even takes him up on it. So on the last day of the crisis, when Khrushchev does bring it up, he's very eager to take it. And in fact, he is the only one in the room who's willing to take it. You know, there's been this model from the first draft of history on that the room was divided into hawks and doves and centrists. But in fact, on the last couple of days of the crisis, the room was divided between John Kennedy and everybody else. Everybody else in that room wanted to bomb the missiles in Cuba, and only John Kennedy wanted to take the trade.
Now, unaccustomed as we are to having presidential tapes reveal the president in a positive light,
yeah,
Nixon certainly was ensnared by his own voice on tape. It must have had an astonishing effect. When were the tapes released, and how long did it take before this real version of history informed our public understanding of the crisis?
Word of the tapes first came out in 1982, 20 years after the crisis, when several of Kennedy's advisors, McGeorge Bundy, Robert McNamara, a few others, wrote a little article in Time magazine in which they admitted that the myth of the Cuban Missile Crisis was false. When I interviewed Ted Sorensen about this 5 years ago, he admitted that basically Kennedy, after that last XCOM meeting, he took seven people into his office and he told them that, look, I'm sending my brother over to the Soviet embassy and I'm going to accept this deal, but you can't tell anybody. And that after Kennedy was assassinated, they all got together and pledged that nobody would ever reveal this. The first tape was revealed in 1987, and it was of the last day of the crisis where Khrushchev comes out with a deal and Kennedy says, hey, this is a pretty good deal. And everybody in the room is shouting him down, saying this will wreck NATO. We can't do this. It'll ruin our credibility. Kennedy lets them talk on, and at one point he says, look, to any man at the United Nations or any other rational man, it will look like a very fair trade. I'm reading from the transcript here. And later he also says, and this I think is the telling point, he says, well, I'm just thinking about what we're going to have to do in a day or so, which is 500 sorties. The airstrike plan called for 500 air sorties against the Cuban missile sites every day for 7 days.
I've been thinking about what we're going to have to do in a day or so, which is 500 sorties in 7 days and possibly an invasion, all because we wouldn't take missiles out of Turkey. We all know how...
Kennedy goes on, all because we wouldn't take missiles out of Turkey. We all know how quickly everybody's courage goes when the blood starts to flow, and that's what is going to happen to NATO. When they start these things and they grab Berlin, everybody's going to say, well, that was a pretty good proposition.
Memoirists. Once these revelations came out in McGeorge Bundy's own memoir, how did journalism react? Having been unwitting accomplices in a historical lie, did newspapers jump on this story to kind of set the record straight, and do you think it had any effect?
I have to say, both among journalists and historians, this chapter of the Cuban Missile Crisis has not yet been fully incorporated into the dominant narrative, as academics might call it today. And to the degree that people do know there was a trade, it is as yet not generally well accepted how alone Kennedy was.
I'm curious about how much the truth of the Cuban Missile Crisis has found its way into the public consciousness. If it has, I suppose you can credit the film 13 Days from 2 years ago. Hollywood took another look at the history books and did substantially incorporate our current understanding in that film. Let's hear a little bit of that.
We've got time for one more round of diplomacy, and that's it. First airstrikes start in 28 hours.
But we have to make them agree to it.
Right.
So how do we do that?
Well, we give them something. We tell them we're going to remove the missiles from Turkey. Yeah. Hang on. But we do that 6 months from now, so it appears there's no linkage.
We also tell them if they go public about it, we'll deny it.
Right. We deny it. The deal's off.
And we do it under the table so we can disavow any knowledge of it.
It's transparent, Kenny. The press will be all over it.
6 months from now, we're not going to care, are we?
That was Bruce Greenwood playing Kennedy, and Kevin Costner as Kenny O'Donnell, presidential appointments secretary, who took on a very important role, at least in the film.
Yeah, well, you know, generally that film, in terms of a historical dramatization, isn't bad. The business about Kenny O'Donnell was just ludicrous. It was co-produced by, I believe, a nephew of Kenny O'Donnell. You can go through the tapes and transcripts. Kenny O'Donnell was there maybe twice and said one sentence about how to deal with the press about something. He wasn't in on this deal whatsoever. As I said, that wasn't a bad film historically, though, except that it made Bobby Kennedy and Robert McNamara and some others look quite a bit more dovish than they really were. Even Bobby Kennedy, toward the end, was very much against the Turkish trade, very much in favor of attacking the missile sites.
In your review of that film, 13 Days, you made another point about learning from history. It was about the supposition that a president surrounded by a circle of trusted advisors can be depended on to make the right decision. And you made a connection to the George W. Bush White House. Make it again.
The point was, I think George W. Bush had just been elected president, and a lot of people were wondering if he would be smart enough to deal with crises. And the common explanation at the time was, well, don't worry, he has a lot of really smart people around him. And the point that you can take from the fourth draft of the history of the Cuban Missile Crisis is that the people around John Kennedy were really smart. I mean, these were the people that David Halberstam later called, in a note of irony, the best and the brightest. And yet John Kennedy realized that they really weren't very smart after all. And the lesson of that is that you can have good advisors, but the crucial thing is that you need a president. It's the president who makes the decisions.
Well, Fred Kaplan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Fred Kaplan is the New York bureau chief for the Boston Globe and author of Wizards of Armageddon, a collective biography of nuclear strategists.
Up next, a high school newspaper celebrates a century of breeding big-time journalists and a half-century of Cinerama.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last weekend, the high school newspaper The Record celebrated its centennial year. Published by students of the prestigious Horace Mann School in New York City, The Record has been named one of the best high school newspapers by the American Scholastic Press Association. Some of the journalistic luminaries who began their careers at The Record celebrated at a dinner at the school's Bronx campus. John Kalish reports.
The Horace Mann Record has produced three Pulitzer Prize winners, enough newspaper journalists to practically fill a city room, and an impressive list of alumni who didn't go into journalism. Past editors include a couple of congressmen, a former defense secretary, the current attorney general of New York State, Jack Kerouac, New Yorker cartoonist Ed Koren, and George Avakian, the legendary jazz producer. The Record's current faculty advisor, Claude Catapano, has read through all 100 years of the student newspaper.
3 or 4 years before Brown for Supportive Education, we had editorial calling for integration. The height of McCarthy era, Bob Caro publishes a paper in Russian with Eleanor Roosevelt's encouragement. Basically said, you know, we have to do something.
Robert Caro was editor of the Record in 1953.
It was on the Record that I first found out how angry people could get at you.
In the Record's time-honored tradition, Caro clashed with the administration of the prestigious private school. Caro agitated for a new honor system at Horace Mann, modeled after one at Princeton University in which students were left alone in classrooms during tests.
I started writing editorials for it, and finally there was a vote, and the students approved it. So I wrote an editorial called Green Light Means Go, and arranged to have the Record distributed the morning of that assembly. Then I gave a talk on it at the assembly, and I can still remember to this day, as I walked up the aisle after giving the talk, how the old faculty members were standing there glaring at me.
Caro won a Pulitzer Prize in 1975 for his biography of Robert Moses. Horace Mann's other Pulitzer winners are Richard Kluger of the class of 52 and Anthony Lewis of the class of 44. On more than one occasion, school administrators tried to stop the Record from publishing stories about drug use on campus. That brought loud complaints from alumni and a front-page story decrying censorship.
I did a poll on what percentage of the kids smoked marijuana and published it.
Pollster Mark Penn, who has worked for President Clinton, conducted his first polls in the Horace Mann Record when he was a student in the early 1970s.
It revealed that 37% of Horace Manners had tried marijuana. And then my faculty advisor got very upset that I was going to ruin admissions to the school with the poll. I almost got fired for that poll.
Amy Schwartz, now a Washington Post editorial writer, joined the Record as a ninth grader 1 year after Horace Mann went co-ed.
It was one of the pleasures of the big boys on the Record staff, the 11th and 12th graders, whom I naturally held in total awe, to tease me and say that when I grew up, I would probably be the first female editor of the Record.
Schwartz did become the Record's first woman editor in 1979. By the time her appointment came, she says it was no big deal on campus. Today, the school has a publication called Harriet, described as a radical feminist journal for the young and disgruntled. Shari Rudofsky, the editor of the Record in 1984, says she loved meeting deadlines and telling people what was going on. Today, Rudofsky freelances for the Miami Herald and the Boston Globe.
In a way, some of the best examples of what community journalism can be are places like Horace Mann, where you have a small community of people who care a lot about what goes on. And I think that having started in this environment, I was really attuned to the place a newspaper has in a community.
In the late 1980s, editors of the Record, along with student activists, pushed the school to pull its investments in South Africa. David Leonhardt was a reporter on the Record back then. He's now a reporter with the New York Times.
I played a relatively minor role in it, but it was without question a defining experience to realize that words you write can have an impact and can affect the world around you.
When asked why this century-old student newspaper turned out so many top journalists, a number of former editors said the Record gave them a sense of freedom and responsibility. For On the Media, I'm John Kalish in New York.
For film geeks looking to heighten the home viewing experience, there's a new toy on the web that's sure to please. It's called DVD Tracks, and it's do-it-yourself DVD commentary. You can record and share your own insights, or you can download other people's commentary and listen while you watch the film.
Here's a taste of some of the commentary you could be listening to while you curl up with, say, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
this part is, for me, probably the creepiest part in the movie. I'm not a vegetarian. I do eat burgers when I can afford them. I'm a poor-ass college student. I got no room to be a vegetarian.
Fascinating insight from just a regular guy. The whole operation was inspired by a Yahoo Internet Life column by Roger Ebert called You Too Can Be a DVD Movie Critic. Patrick Stein, a computer programmer from Minneapolis, launched the DVD Tracks website. Mark Yarm wrote about it for Salon.com, and he joins me now. Mark, welcome to OTM.
Hi, thanks.
Do you think this is a step closer to the age of fully integrated internet and television experience, so-called convergence?
I mean, it's a step in that direction. Right now, it's very clunky. You have to put your computer alongside your, you know, television set and your DVD player and play. But in the future, you know, there might be DVD players that can play an MP3 concurrently with the image.
Well, apart from the obvious attraction to, you know, a diary writer to share his thoughts with whatever public may be out there, do you think that the technology has a future that may transcend, you know, its basic masturbatory quality?
When it's made a little easier, perhaps more people might enter into the fray. There are a couple of commercially available DVDs that pick up on this, and one is Kevin Smith's movie, Jay and Silent Bob. It's the first commercially available DVD I know that has a commentary feature, and basically using a DVD-ROM, you can upload your commentary on select scenes to the movie site, which is hosted by Miramax, and share them with other users. The Spider-Man DVD comes out in early November, and that also is going to have a commentary feature on it. But the only problem there is that you won't be able to share it with people. You'll have to play it back on your own computer.
Is that because of the intellectual property rights? The studio doesn't want to surrender its DVD to the annotation whims of anyone who wants to download his thoughts?
Hollywood doesn't want you to alter its movies. I don't think they're going to object to a bunch of MP3s on some site. But once you start getting in there into the DVD and changing stuff, they're going to get annoyed.
Hollywood has historically been very short-sighted about technology and how it may actually help sales rather than hinder them. If everyone could record his own thoughts on DVDs, isn't one of the possibilities that Hollywood would be selling a lot more DVDs?
I spoke to a man named Ernest Miller, who is a fellow at the Information Society project at Yale. And his argument was, you know, why not have people be able to sell these things on Amazon? You know, when XXX comes out on DVD, you wanted to buy that. You could see who's made commentary on it. And, you know, if they got a big name, that might attract people. And people could see what sort of commentaries were up there, and it would add value to the DVD.
Well, and that, I think, gets back to Roger Ebert's original idea, which was to give a perspective to a piece of art that someone on the production team, like the director, wouldn't be able to provide.
Right. I mean, for instance, he said, why don't we give it to someone who was on the set but was disgruntled, and then they could, you know, dish the dirt on everything that happened behind the scenes, or have a psychologist remark, a memento, or a different expert. He also gave an example, maybe a Vietnam vet comment on Platoon. So people could lend their particular area of expertise. Right now, DVD Tracks isn't particularly doing that. It's mostly, you know, a bunch of guys, almost exclusively guys, commenting on, you know, Star Wars. Not that they're not necessarily entertaining or insightful, but it's not reaching the full potential that Ebert had envisioned.
Right now, it's just sort of a digital vanity press.
I mean, I guess you could say that if you wanted to be cynical about it.
I do.
Okay, you do.
I wrote a term paper on this thing, and I'd like to share bits and pieces of it with you as we comment on the movie here. I got an A+ on this in a history of cinema class. I guess the guy really liked it.
It's mostly people just sharing their thoughts, and, you know, everyone says, who cares? Some people care.
Okay. Mark Yarm, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Yarm is a freelance writer. He wrote about DVD Tracks for Salon.com.
We just heard about a brand new technology that may or may not enhance your movie watching pleasure. Now a salute to an older innovation. It was just 50 years ago that the square screen gave way to the widescreen and changed the way we look at film. Sarah Fischko has this tribute to Cinerama.
When was the last time you got dressed up to go to a movie? 50 years ago, on September 30th, 1952 to be exact, everybody in the movie audience at the Broadway Theater on 53rd Street was dressed up. It was the premiere of Cinerama, which would literally change the shape of things to come. A large velvet curtain covering the screen opened part way to reveal world traveler, correspondent Lowell Thomas.
A movie started, a regular movie, you know, like a square image on a screen.
Filmmaker David Strohmeyer saw Cinerama as a young child.
The favorite memory is Lowell Thomas saying, "Ladies and gentlemen, this is Cinerama."
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Cinerama.
And the curtain opened to the widest screen ever seen.
And then you hear this huge loud noise, which is a clang of a roller coaster starting with all the rumbling. And the curtain's opening all at the same time. It's like one of those goosebump moments.
Cinerama, the pioneering widescreen process, used three images projected at once to create a wide, curved picture that mirrored what the eye could see, peripheral vision and all. It came along at a particular moment. It was the early 1950s.
During the post-war period, people were coming off of 40-hour weeks that they worked during the war.
John Belton is the author of a book called Widescreen Cinema.
And 2-week vacations became a routine part of everyone's employment package in this post-war period. So people had lots and lots of leisure time to do things. And they didn't want to go to the movies anymore.
They wanted to buy cars, they wanted to go on trips, barbecue in the backyard, entertain.
All of these activities are not things you can do in 2 hours. There's a kind of refocusing of leisure time.
And there was TV, of course. And the movie business felt it all. Movie attendance dropped by 50% between 1948 and 1952. Cinerama was just what the business needed. Cinerama was the brainchild of inventor Fred Waller, who brought it to showman Mike Todd and adventurer Lowell Thomas, who was convinced the new format would revolutionize the industry.
My father had traveled so much around the world, he was full of ideas.
Lowell Thomas Jr.
of things that could be done with this widescreen technique that actually embraced about 140 degrees.
Cinerama screens were huge, 60 feet wide, with 15 feet deep curves on either side.
And it'd be so much better to look at the world with the same kind of view that the human eye has when you're right out there, instead of like looking through a keyhole, which was basically the motion picture technique in those early days.
So that's what early Cinerama pictures were, travelogues, with more than a dash of kitsch, titles like Search for Paradise and South Seas Adventures, with stereophonic scores to match their spectacularly sized pictures.
It was always very American.
David Strohmeyer has just completed a documentary film on the history of Cinerama.
They would start out in the United States. They'd be flying over the Statue of Liberty, something on our trip around the world, you know. And even the announcer, Lowell Thomas, would say, "Next stop, Bangkok," or something, you know. And then suddenly you'd be swooping down into Bangkok and you'd get an aerial view of it. Next stop, something else. At the end of the movie, you would get this very rousing patriotic thing where the Mormon Tabernacle Choir was singing, "This is my country," or something. And then the movie would be over.
And it was incredibly successful, even in that first year, 1952, when the first film, This is Cinerama, was playing in only one theater. And remember, this was an independent production, East Coast-based.
Hollywood was getting pretty concerned. It was filling up every night. People could not get tickets. You had a waiting list of 3 and 4 months to get tickets to see Cinerama. And then you go down to the local movie theater where they're playing Shane or something, and it was maybe a third full.
This is Cinerama was the top-grossing film of 1952. Soon after it appeared, Pizzaramas and Burgeramas, Launderamas and Motoramas dotted the main streets of America.
Don't buy any food keeper until you've seen the fabulous Foodorama by Kelvinny.
Cole Porter used it in his lyrics to a song from Silk Stocking.
Cinerama.
Vista Vision R.
Superscope R.
President Eisenhower takes an afternoon off to see a movie.
Cinerama went to the very top.
It's a special showing of Cinerama.
And they even tried to make real Cinerama movies with star directors like John Ford and Henry Hathaway. How the West Was Won was filmed in Cinerama, its theme of the expansion of the West seemed somehow related to the format. And The Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm.
And not another word out of anyone.
Whose theme seemed not related at all.
Once upon a time, there was a cobbler.
And Cinerama was not immune to Cold War politics either. The Soviets invented their own widescreen three-camera process called Kinopanorama. And the two countries battled it out over screen size. But it rose and it fell. It presented huge artistic, financial, and logistical problems to filmmakers because of its three-strand technology. Later, the studios created single-panel, widescreen formats with compound names. VistaVision, Panavision, CinemaScope, Technoscope, and there was 3D. And in a whole new concept, Smell-O-Vision, which pumped aromatic oils into movie theaters to enhance the film-going experience. The advertising campaign for Smell-O-Vision, by the way, provided a lovely capsule lesson in the history of movies. First They Moved, 1895. Then They Talked, 1927. Now They Smell. But I digress. Right now, a few impassioned people are busy trying to preserve the Cinerama story, as well as the physical remains, if you will, of the process. The prints, in particular, of the few films made in the original three-part system, complete with seams showing between the panels when they're projected. That's all part of it. The seams, the ungainly equipment, the novelty of even having tried it at all.
It is a novelty, but it is more than that. To this day, every movie theater you walk into, Cinerama has had its effect, not only just on the filmmakers, but on the fact that you're watching a screen that is not square anymore. It's wide. Cinerama did create the revolution that Lowell Thomas said it would.
So put on your tux, your gown, and toast the process that made movies wide.
I think it's great just to bring it back, you know, 50 years later, to just have a reminder of how it started and who started it.
Maybe it will come to your town soon.
I'd sure like to see it again.
For On the Media, I'm Sarah Fishko.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Megan Ryan, engineered by Rob Christensen and George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Natasha Kurganker, Andy Lancet, Wayne Schulmeister, and Sharon Ball. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Arama.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.